I like how you said that with complete and utter derision.
You did.
How dare he call himself an entrepreneur and a philanthropist? He's either stealing money from people or he's giving money to people.
Well, you know, the implication is there. He happens to own a matte black Lamborghini, which presumably he got by acting like St. Francis of Assisi and giving away his stuff to the poor.
People of the world, people of planet Earth, welcome to Season 3, Episode 4 of Bad Voltage. It's great to have you all here. I hope you're all safe and well in these challenging times. I'm here with my compadre, Stuart Ian Langridge, and Jeremy Jesus Garcia. So, we're going to get into some interesting stuff today. How are you guys doing? What's going on? What's new?
I don't think Jesus is a word.
I like how he just inserts one random, usually Muppetist thing. And you gotta wait for it. You never know what it will be, but it will be Muppety in nature.
Did we ever establish whether you have a middle name?
I don't know if we've established it. I'm gonna keep it a mystery now.
Do you?
Oh,
maybe.
He's being deliberately mysterious as this is no good, right? Okay, in that case, you deserve all the stupid names Jono makes up for. I'm fine with it now.
People of the Bad Voltage community, go onto Slack and share, what do you think Jeremy's middle name is? I would like to
possibly end well.
If one person guesses it correctly before the next show, I will send them an LQ shirt.
Oh, look at that. Wow, there you go. You can bag yourself an LQ shirt from Jeremy Bernard Garcia. All right, so...
send in your entries to Jeremy Aloysius Garcia at LugRadio.org. Oh, no.
Aloysius.
Does anyone actually have the middle name Aloysius?
I don't believe so.
We can't all be as British as you, Jonathan Edward James Bacon III.
Sadly, those are indeed my middle names. All right, and now this.
First thing, did you see that, you know, Jay-Z, someone made an AI thing which imitates people's voices. You may have seen a thing called Lyrebird a few years ago where you could feed it text and it would read it out as Barack Obama or something like that. Well, someone did a similar thing, and he's been doing it for a bunch of people's voices, and then he did it for Jay-Z, reading the words to We Didn't Start the Fire by Billy Joel, and apparently Mr. Zed got his knickers in a twist and lawyered up at the response to this.
You are joking.
Nah, straight up, right? Got it knocked off of YouTube. YouTube have since reinstated this. But initially he got it pushed off of YouTube. It's like, dude, have a sense of humor. I mean, yeah, fine. We could have all the, oh no, what about deep fakes? Are they a big thing? But this is the funny bit. So don't care about any of that, Jay-Z. Jay-Z's an idiot.
He seems unnecessarily serious about this.
From this day forward, will definitely be known as Mr. Zed.
Mr. Zed, the humorless wanker. Sounds like a chap hop artist.
Yeah, that's disappointing.
So the next thing, there was a bill. This is in the Virginia General Assembly. And I don't know a lot about this because the newspaper reporting it won't show me the article because apparently I'm outside the United States of America. But
yeah.
Apparently they attempted to pass a bill, make it legal to drive drunk while you were at home. Right, it got passed in the Virginia Senate, but then, and I'm quoting directly from the article here, lawmakers in the House blocked it Friday after deciding it was too difficult to draw a distinction between the guy calmly drinking beer while listening to the radio in a parked car and the guy doing donuts on his front lawn.
The whole article, though, is filled with gems. There is also the, you know, this is a tough nut, Stuart, I assume Langridge said. He told the subcommittee last week, I'm trying to protect the person who moves the car in his driveway.
So it seems to be more about can you have an open container inside of a car It doesn't sound like it's actually about driving drunk. It sounds like, can you just sit in a car, drink and drink beer, right?
I mean, as you know, I tend to be more about the government overreach than possibly either of you two, and certainly more than a lot of Americans. But even I bet say there are some things where maybe the law should just go, dude, whatever, stop wasting time on this. And one of them is, yeah, can I own beer and a car in my own driveway?
Well, and also, I would disagree with the notion that it is difficult to draw the distinction between the guy calmly drinking beer while listening to the radio in a parked car and the guy doing donuts in his front lawn. These two seem very simple things to distinguish between. So...
Still on car news.
More motoring.
We've become some kind of new version of Top Gear. It's amazing. It's hard to describe this article, so I'm going to start off by reading the headline. And to be clear, this is not in, you know, News of the Weird or something. This is in the Washington Post.
This is a corker.
The headline is, Boy 5... steals family car in attempt to buy a Lamborghini. Then a man with a Lamborghini shows up at his house. So this is a five-year-old kid who took $3 out of his piggy bank, stole the keys to his parents' SUV in Utah, and then drove on the freeway. He got pulled over by a copper doing 32 mile an hour and told this highway patrol officer that he was on his way to California to buy a Lamborghini sports car.
This is what America is, Stuart. Embrace it.
It is. Honestly, the whole article is like, it's like a story you tell a child to warn them about why not to move to America. Apparently a bunch of people think that Adrian, which is the name of the kid, who is, let's be clear, 5, they think he should go to jail. And then, since we're, we want to end on an up note slightly, so there's a chap called Jeremy Neves, who is an entrepreneur and philanthropist from Utah. I'm not sure what that actually means he does. But
how you said that with complete and utter derision.
Like, you did.
How dare he call himself an entrepreneur and a philanthropist? He's either stealing money from people or he's giving money to people.
Well, you know, the implication is there. He happens to own a matte black Lamborghini, which presumably he got by acting like St. Francis of Assisi and giving away his stuff to the poor. But anyway... this guy, who I actually have quite a lot of time for, considering he did this, he read about this, got in his matte black Lamborghini, drove round to the kid's house, took the kid out for a drive in the Lamborghini, which I think is pretty cool, actually.
It is cool.
Yeah.
You know, I mean... Yeah. I still mostly hate the guy, partially because he calls himself an entrepreneur and philanthropist, and secondly because he owns a Lamborghini Huracan and I don't. But nonetheless...
Right, there we go. That's where it's at, ladies and gentlemen. That's where it's at.
And the final thing is something I noticed, and then the DuckDuckGo people... mentioned that I'd noticed it and destroyed my Twitter mentions for a week. But Twitter maintain a list of your interests. This is things that they've divined by what you look at, you know, the same way Google do, where they divine a list of your interests to know what ads to show you and so on. But Twitter's list is bizarre, right?
Yeah.
So we'll link to the list in the show notes. You should go and look at your own list. But Jono, You have followed my instructions and not looked at your list, right?
I have not. Because I have not looked at my list.
I like the idea of getting the unvarnished reaction on what someone thinks when they look at their own list. So, I mean, some of them are sensible.
I don't
particularly
want to read out whatever's on my list, by the way.
Well, it depends on what you look at and whether you're using a VPN when you do it. But... So, a question to get you started. Is egg on your list of interests?
Hang on.
Not eggs or recipes with eggs or cooking with eggs. Just egg.
There's a lot of stuff on here. Let me have a look.
I do not have egg on mine.
I do have egg on my list. I have egg on my list.
a load of people, because I thought, that's weird, egg is on my list, how strange, when I deleted it. And then loads of people followed up this DDG post going, why is egg on my list?
The thing is, some of it is things I completely understand how they got on there. And some are so far off the mark that whatever model they're using for this is just not good. I also have, books.
Oh, I have four books.
It's four separate line items. I mean, I like me a book, don't get me wrong, but four seems aggressive.
I have Animal Crossing on my list, and I don't really understand what Animal Crossing is. I know it's a game that lots of people are playing right now.
It's a game that everyone's playing on the Switch, yes.
Yeah. Why have I got Animal Crossing on my list?
I'm guessing because Jack has used your computer.
Yeah, I've got dining experience, which is nice.
The list is weird. I mean, I'm sure when they came up with this list, a bunch of people on Twitter sat around a table and said the word folksonomy a lot, right? But then, presumably 5 years later, someone went, oh, well, because we care about privacy now, we've got this list. We better expose it to users so they can see what it is. And no one ever thought about things like data cleaning, which is why they've got four independent categories all called books and so on.
I am way more interesting than I thought I was. I've got Football Americano de la NFL on my list and healthcare system in Brazil. Wow. Apparently, I'm really into MLB baseball as well.
I also have a bunch of people who I've never heard of.
Yeah. It's bizarre. It's a bizarre
thing. This is very interesting. Go and share your list, people.
Yes, so we'd like to hear about your list. But yeah, if you want to look at it, we'll link to it in the show notes. Or if you go to Twitter and then go into settings and then into content preferences, you can't stop them collecting the data, but you can stop them personalizing your view based on it.
Ooh, so Google Nexus, very timely.
If you're honestly finding it genuinely valuable that Twitter occasionally shows you things about egg, then don't delete the list. Otherwise.
So have you ever gotten a Twitter promoted tweet or whatever about egg?
Maybe.
I don't know. I mean, I assume not, but then what would such a thing look like?
Well, and Twitter advertising is garbage, right? Because as we've just demonstrated, the targeting is terrible.
Hey, you know how... So, if someone is... Russian bots are all a bit more sophisticated now, but 2 years ago, they were all called, you know, John01319070506 or whatever. And you knew they were bots because they hadn't uploaded an avatar. And so the default avatar is...
An egg!
So maybe... This is pure hypothesis, to be clear.
No, it sounds like a research study.
Well, if someone wants to employ the Bad Voltage Institute for Studies to look into this in great detail, our lines are open. Send us a grant. And meanwhile, all right, let's have some more serious news.
Let's get into some more serious stuff. So apparently the .org registry is not going to be sold, which is quite nice. We covered this in a previous show, which is great.
We covered this one at length, So I'm a little surprised that came around. It was kind of forced their hand, the California Attorney General there, but...
I mean, there's not a lot to be said about it other than, you know, good. But it is interesting how this gives a bit more ammunition to the whole sunlight is the best disinfectant people.
I am curious. The way that the wording from ICANN came out, I think they left the door open to a potential for this to happen again in the future if different parameters are followed. So curious to see 2 years down the line if there's another attempt at this in a different way or if this is kind of... the last we hear of this.
Well,
kind of thing.
I mean, maybe next time they'll privatize .biz or something and no one will care. Oh no, .museum is being sold. .lol.
Is there .egg?
I'm calling the show .egg now. Brilliant.
There should be. I mean, ever since Chicken Stop mentioned this whole Twitter thing, then I think we should be encouraging the .egg. Right. Domain.
This is the serious bit of the news.
Oh, yeah,
that's right. No egg jokes.
No egg jokes. I know. That was a cracking joke.
Oof.
Cracking yolk. Tim Bray has quit Amazon. Did you see this?
I did.
Quite the principled move.
It was.
Yeah, I mean, he'd been there for, a couple of years, something like that?
More than that. Five or six, I'd say.
Oh, really?
I think it's been a while. Yeah, I mean, I think he moved around, did a couple of different things while he was there, but I remember him going there. I mean, on the one hand, this is obviously punishment for inventing XML. On the other hand, he's a good bloke, Tim Bray. He's a smart thinker. And like you say, this is a very principled move. As far as I can tell, he's walked away from a dump truck full of money here.
Yep.
And it's and the basic gist of things from what I read was there was some work going on around this global climate strike walkout. And then a whistleblower was identified inside of Amazon, and they were fired. And then apparently there was a whole bunch of pretty nasty stuff said about them inside of some leaked executive meeting notes. And Tim Bray was just outraged by this and was like, that's it, I'm out. So now the thing here is that, to me, sounds like a very principled approach. And I think we should be protecting whistleblowers because it's important, right? But yep. There's always two sides to a story in these situations. And I'm curious what actually happened from Amazon's perspective. Because
he was pretty transparent about he raised it internally through the channels that they have for this type of thing and didn't feel that the outcome was good.
Right.
He also said, interestingly, that he fully admits that the AWS side of the house actually treats their employees quite well, and that he's really happy with how AWS treats their employees. It's the fulfillment and Amazon warehouse side that is not. So he's taken the mindset that by supporting AWS side of the house, because they are the same company, he felt that he was supporting the other side and had to take a stand. Which
it's all one Amazon. Yeah.
It is all one Amazon,
I mean, and he specifically says, I'm quoting from his write-up about it, he brought it up, and so on, he says, the justifications were laughable. It was clear to any reasonable observer that they were turfed for whistleblowing. And, obviously, Amazon aren't going to say, we fired them because they're whistleblowers, but honestly, it's just coincidence, is it?
Well, and the thing is, and this is really a topic for another show that I think would actually be interesting to get into. The tricky thing here, I think, with the topic of whistleblowers is, my personal view is, if you're inside of a business and you've done everything that you can to try and raise a concern, and you are literally just, everything is getting pushed back, and there's something unethical going on, right? Then it's perfectly reasonable to be a whistleblower. I think people who just leak information publicly, that's a separate question, and there's a line between how you do that. So a good example of this is Edward Snowden. Like, I think the way Snowden approached it was more than reasonable. He went through every possible avenue to raise concerns about what was going on and couldn't do it, so he became a whistleblower. But then there is this, again, where is the line between being responsible in trying to solve a problem and then just unilaterally leaking stuff on the internet, for example? And that's a really difficult subject, but, you know, kudos to Tim Bray for getting up there.
I mean, certainly the impression I have from what's been said about this is that these people were well on your okay side of the line. This
wasn't like a borderline
thing or anything. Yeah, I mean, even if there conceivably are situations where it's doubtful whether someone is, you know, a good-hearted whistleblower or doing it out of spite, this is not that one of those cases. Fair play to Bray for doing it.
I know we try to cover these quickly, but I do have a question. Do you think, given how profile Tim Bray is, that this will make any difference?
No.
No.
Not at all. And I actually don't think Tim Bray is particularly high profile. I think he was. But I bet a lot of younger technologists have no idea who he is.
I mean, this made New York Times, Washington Post, most of the large Wall Street Journal. But I think he's a pretty big name still.
I mean, I think in the tech industry, and I'm prepared to buy Jono's point that he was a more known name in the tech industry 10 years ago than he is now. The reason he was in the Washington Post is not because he invented XML, it's because he's a VP of Amazon and this is a story. It could have been anyone else. The thing is, exactly as you said, he works for the bit of the organization who treat their staff well. And so the fact that Amazon already have people internally who wouldn't treat staff terribly hasn't made any difference to the Amazon fulfillment side. And I don't see how someone else going, you shouldn't do this. I mean, if you read some of these articles about the conditions there are there, and anyone doing that is not going, I'm going to treat you know, our warehouse packing staff brilliantly and as well as I possibly can. They're going, we're gonna pay people the minimum we can get away with and work them as hard as we can in order to keep our prices down. They already know they're doing this. Someone calling them out publicly about doing it doesn't make any difference, I don't think.
No, I agree. Let's do one more because we're running out of time. What do you want to do? We got two. What's more interesting?
The Bloomberg thing, I think. Well, it's not a Bloomberg thing.
Right.
It's a Facebook thing. But Jeremy, do you want to talk about this?
Sure. So threw me a curveball there. Facebook announced a little while ago that they were going to have a content board that was completely independent, and they have now followed through. It took them about 2 years, it seems like. So it's going to be about 20 people, but they had the four people who will serve as the chairs. And it consists of a special rapporteur on freedom of expression from the Organization of American States, a law professor at Columbia, a law professor at Stanford, and a former prime minister of Denmark. So they went with some fairly heavy hitters. And what they're going to do is set up a private trust. You can, if something gets taken down in the beginning, you can say it shouldn't have. Eventually, you'll also be able to say, I would like to take this down. But they said that's going to be kind of phase two. So if something is taken down and you think it shouldn't have been, you can appeal to this board, which they claim Zuckerberg is now on record saying that he will not overrule anything that they decide and that they have kind of carte blanche once it reaches them to make a decision. So interesting bit of transparency from an organization not really known for transparency. Curious what you both think of this.
I mean, they're trying, aren't they? They are trying.
Kind of, but it's like someone's written about, someone who's read about the idea of doing things right in a book, but doesn't really understand it. So
bear in mind that that's a massive organization. It takes time to turn things around. And the challenge with Facebook as well. Well, I was going to say the challenge with Facebook as well is all of their revenue, from what I can tell, comes from advertising. And the reason why their advertising works so well is because it's so hyper-targeted towards people's. By definition, the fact that people are loose with their privacy is meaning that people have got the ability to advertise.
I mean, it's a good thing that this exists, and I'm glad that it exists. But to me, it feels a bit like, let me think of an example. It's like you're trying to go into your local baker's, and they don't have a ramp. They've only got steps. And you say, but I can't get up the steps. There should be a ramp. And someone says, okay, we'll solve that problem for you. And they create the Supreme Court. Right? I mean, yes, eventually the case you're bringing against your baker will get to that point, and then hopefully they'll decide in your favor. But, you know, at this board, they've explicitly said, you know, we're going to select a few flowers or maybe weeds from a field of possibilities. They're going to be picking individual important cases on which a bunch of internal Facebook jurisprudence depends. Should we do this or should we do that? There's going to be a lot of discussion and process around it. Working with this board is going to be the same as being a lawyer working with the Supreme Court is. You can't just make an argument. You've got to spend ages preparing for it and everything. It's a good thing that it exists, but it feels like fixing a million small things is maybe better than fixing one high-profile big thing, because exactly as Jono says, the one high-profile big thing they ought to fix is stop really narrowly targeting people when they don't want you to, and they're not going to because their whole entire business model depends on it.
Right. Well, and the thing is, I'm sure that this thing is, I have a little bit of sympathy towards Facebook, because I'm sure that this thing is, it's just one of a number of things that they're doing, right? They were raked over the coals over the Cambridge Analytica thing, and they're clearly trying to make changes happening. Like I'm seeing on Facebook, for example, when people post things, often it'll say, this has been identified as fake news, and it'll appear over the item that's been posted. It's great that they're doing some things like this. I'm sure this is just one other thing that they're putting in place. So they're not gonna be able to change the ship immediately, but I'd rather have this oversight board be there than not be there.
Well,
personally.
Yeah. I mean, I'm in favor of it. As I said, I'm in favor of it existing rather than not existing. But I don't know how much actual difference he'll make.
I have a bit of a story to tell when it comes to just myself, I guess you could say. So a little while ago, I was experiencing some shoulder pain, right? Right shoulder, kind of just tweaking a little bit. I'd been going swimming and my shoulder was aching after I'd been swimming. And I went to the doctor and she referred me to go and see a physical therapist. And I went to go and see a physical therapist. And the PT basically said, your posture is total shit. I was like, okay. So,
and you said, that's not fair. I quite like spaghetti. I don't know what you're talking about.
Ah, well played, sir. Well played.
Was it though?
So anyways.
Was it?
I said, well, okay, well, what do you mean by that? And she said, well, you're hunched over. Your shoulders are hunched over. You're not standing straight. And what happens is all of these muscles in your body are completely connected, right? So she then started giving me exercises to basically get my posture as it should be. And what was causing a bit of a problem is that my arm started experiencing almost like RSI type symptoms. It's actually called cubital tunnel syndrome. Because the nerve in my shoulder was being pinched and it was causing this problem down my arm. And it was all from posture. And this got me thinking. I was never taught anything about posture when I was growing up. You know, nothing in school about how to use a computer correctly, how to sit correctly, any of that kind of stuff. The first time I really heard about ergonomics was, I think, when I got my first office job, when I worked at Open Advantage, and they made sure that I had a proper chair. But it was kind of like, here's an ergonomic chair, and it's okay if you slouch in it, right? So it wasn't really properly learning how to do it. But did you guys grow up with any of that stuff about how to have proper posture or anything along those lines?
Obviously not.
Did you, Jeremy, in America, did you grow up with any of that?
No, absolutely not.
Not only did we not grow up with it, I spoke to my daughter, who is a teacher in a school, and said, young people taught about this kind of thing today? And she laughed so hard her spleen fell out. No one is taught this at all.
It's amazing. Like, people aren't taught pretty important principles. Like, I don't remember learning when I was at school about how to file your taxes, about how the stock market works, about posture. These things that it's good for us to know about in our life.
They do not teach life skills to a large degree.
Without wishing to be all political about this, everybody agrees that schools aren't teaching us the right thing. Just no one agrees on what the new list should be. So yeah, you think fair. Posture should be on it? Fine, no problem. Continue.
Yes, I do.
Well played, sir.
Anyway, so we thought it would be interesting to talk about how do you use your computer in a more healthy way, right? So, and what have we learned from doing this? So I've got a couple of things I want to share, but then we also want to get into kind of these digital well-being apps and also how much of this stuff you can reasonably control, because I have the benefit that I work from home, I run my own business, I have complete control over my working environment. It's up to me, okay? But a lot of you are going to work in an office and you might not have the money, or you might not have the boss that allows you to be able to set up this kind of stuff. So I'm going to share a couple of things real quick, okay? The first thing I've discovered, I bought a standing desk, which I love, and I stand most of the time now. And it's like an adjustable thing. I think, Jeremy, you've got one of the same ones, right? The Jarvis.
Yes. Highly recommend.
And I love it. Highly recommend. It's not cheap, but it's great.
Just before you go on, I feel like you should explain to people how not cheap it is. It's one of those things where you think, well, I've got a desk. I bought it from IKEA. It cost me 60 quid. And then the legs were an extra 10 quid. That's about how much a desk costs, right? I'm assuming that your standing desk is not just quite a tall, ordinary desk. I'm assuming it's got some kind of stupid button to press that makes it all happen electronically. And presumably there's an app to control it. So if you're in South America suddenly your desk needs to move, you can do
that. They do make a manual one. I have the one that has a little memory. So you have where you sit, where you stand, then you can also do a manual up down. So it has a couple memories and then manual. I think it's about $500.
So when you say, bear with me, when you say manual, to me that means you turn a little handle and it cranks it up and down. Do you mean you still press a button and it's still electric? You can just position it where you want.
The one is a crank, but granddad, the other one has a 1, 2, actually a 3 and a 4, and then up and down arrow. So you can set it to be exactly where you want to sit and stand, and then in 1/10 inch increments, move it up and down electronic.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's actually really good because, I mean, people will move between sitting and standing, right? But then I find it useful because sometimes I'll need a different height for something else, right? Like if I'm filming a video or whatever else. And it's sturdy and it's high quality and all the rest of it. But I think a standing desk is good. I like it, but they're not cheap. Like, and you can get cheaper ones. And you can get ones that sit on existing desk with the manual crank.
The Berry desk and stuff, yeah.
Yeah. The other thing I found was this thing called an Upright Go. It's a posture monitor. So one of the big problems with posture is that we slouch our shoulders, right? And it's called rounded shoulders. And what you should do is you should have your back straight and your shoulders back and kind of your shoulder blades together a little bit. That's how you should do that. This Upright Go is a little doobry that you charge, and it's got some stickers, and you stick it on your back, and then you sync it with your phone, and you can set your correct posture. And then if you move out of that posture, it's basically like an accelerometer, and it will buzz, so you'll know to go back into the correct posture. And it's amazing how effective that works. It's really helped me a lot. And you know, they're about $70, something like
that. So every day you put this thing on?
Yeah.
And it's altered how you sit.
Oh, massively. Massively. It's massively helped me. And there's
seems
like
something
app
I would buy, put on once, have good posture for a day, and then never wear
and then forget. Yeah. You do have to remember to put it on. And the sticky strips, you know, you can buy your own, like.
Which I assume are a Band-Aid, right? A sticking plaster, except they cost $100 because you bought them off the
company. Women have this stuff called boob tape, which yeah. I've never
right,
heard
so,
of.
Right, so it's basically boob tape. Okay.
It's basically boob tape, yeah.
Does the fact that while you're standing there quietly admiring your posture, it whispers like ads for Squarespace into your ear, does that not bother you? To be clear, it does not do that. Do not sue us, Upright Go people. But it's actually good,
no,
right?
No, it is good. The whispering that I hear in my head is nothing to do with the posture at the Upright Go. It's mainly from the PTSD that I experienced from driving through Coventry once. Anyway,
this episode of Bad Voltage brought to you by Coventry and Upright Go.
I have a stupid question. When you say it buzzes, does it buzz or does your phone buzz?
No, it buzzes. It's got like a it basically vibrates. It's got a little vibration unit.
Why does it need a phone connection?
That's how you set your posture, right? So that when you're sitting is often different.
To go, this is correct.
This is upright.
This is the range of motion. Yeah.
Hmm. That's fair. I was just thinking, can't it know that? But it's just like a little blob the size of the end of your finger. I'm not sure how it knows which way up truly is, you know?
Right. It actually works surprisingly well. I didn't really think it was going to work very well, but it works surprisingly well. The other thing I got, especially given the fact that I stand so much, is a decent floor mat. So do not stand on... I didn't know this. And Erica actually taught me this, that if you stand on like, you know, a hard floor... it really knackers your back in because she experiences it when she's cooking. She loves to cook. And when she's stood there and she's not stood on a mat for a certain period of time, her lower back hurts a lot. So if you're working in a hardwood floor place, whether it's an office or somewhere else, make sure you get an actual decent mat. And don't put like, you know, a towel on the floor. It's got to have some padding to it. That's what I discovered as well.
Yeah, a mat makes a difference if you're going to get a standing desk.
It does. So one of the things I wanted to talk about is, yes, you can do a bunch of this with technology, and that's a good idea, because it is undeniably easy if you get all the right gear. But if you can't, because you don't want to blow 700 quid on a desk, or you haven't got it, or whatever, you can go quite a long way by jury-rigging stuff. I mean,
yes.
So, first of all, you know, everyone listening to this is currently sitting in correct posture because they're listening to it and they've kind of, their shoulders have gradually gone back.
They've adjusted themselves. Going,
I always sit like this. I don't know what you're talking about.
My posture in the last 3 minutes, better than it's ever been.
Right.
But ignoring that, if you're sitting at your desk at the moment or whatever, your monitor should be at eye level, for example.
Yep.
And almost everyone's isn't. It's too low. And you can fix that by just... literally put the monitor on a pile of books, right? I mean, yes, I'm sure someone will sell you an ergonomic monitor stand for $400 in aluminium, but it's just a box, right? Put your monitor on a box. That would be fine.
And the thing is with the standing desk as well, reasonably, there's no reason why you couldn't just get a cardboard box and add, again, put it on books until you get it to like the right height for you.
Yeah.
Because the thing is, there are cheap ways of doing this. Like before I bought this standing desk, before we moved into our new house, I didn't have room in my previous house. So I literally just used a cardboard box and some books and it worked fine. But you got to get it to the right height. The other thing I discovered was you're not really supposed to have your arms completely at a right angle, which is what people talk about, right? You have your arms at a complete right angle when you're using your keyboard. Because if you put too much pressure on your funny bone, that causes this thing called cubital tunnel syndrome. And what it does is some people may, and remember, we're not doctors, but if you've ever felt pain that goes down the side of your arm into your little finger, and your little finger is kind of maybe sometimes a bit numb, that's cubital tunnel syndrome. It's too much pressure on your elbow.
Yes.
So you're actually supposed to have your arms bent a little bit, not straight, but bent a little bit. Again, like, why didn't they teach us this shit when we were at school?
One of the downsides of that is, I mean, I agree with that, and that is absolutely correct advice, but one of the downsides of it is you basically have to be able to touch type. If you can't touch type, having a keyboard at basically waist level and a monitor directly in front of you, really hard to use.
No, not waist level, but I'll give you an example, right? The way I'm stood right now.
Low, you know, your keyboard and your monitor are not 6 inches apart anymore, you know?
Right, but to give you an example, my keyboard right now is basically at a just below belly button height for me.
That's where your waist is.
Your waist lower than that, isn't it? I don't know where my waist is.
Do I not understand what my waist is?
Wow.
Is there a different American and UK definition of waist? I don't know. I've heard about this e-waste. Does that count?
Shut up.
Anyway. But what I've discovered is that if you put your keyboard back, you then basically stand back so your arms are a little bit more outstretched and that's more comfortable. So,
a decent chair is important. And you don't have, yes, if you go and buy an Aeron chair, they are really good and so on, yeah, but it'll cost you $1,000 or whatever. But this is one of the things where you don't really want to skimp on it too much. If you're the sort of person who spends 6 or 7 hours a day sitting in one particular chair, getting one that's even a bit better will help quite a bit. And most offices these days are actually not too bad at this. The days when you got to sit on one of those school chairs are long gone, I think. But
yeah. So, just sheer curiosity here, you just said all these things about monitor height and chair height and all these things. I would say the three of us spend more time in front of computers than the average person, certainly. Have either of you taken the time to measure these things out and actually set these up properly? When you buy a new monitor, do you plop it on your monitor arm or desk and go?
My monitor is, my monitor's got an adjustable, you know, the leg that it's on is adjustable up and down, and I moved it up to approximately the right height. And the chair I picked, it's a Marcus chair from IKEA. So not an Aeron chair, but equally I spent a while reading about this and researching and stuff like that because I spent a lot of time sitting in it and I wanted it to be comfortable. It's got a high back. So it doesn't just come up to like, you know, below my shoulder blades. It comes up right up to my head if it needs to. So I spent a bit of time. I haven't done loads. I haven't done the standing desk thing because I tried it once and it did my head in. But I know Jono's done a lot more towards this than I have. But I have at least done some things. And that's kind of what I mean about you can do a bit and make a material improvement. This is not one of those things where you either do it totally properly or you don't do it at all. You can make some relatively small tweaks and make a relatively large difference. And then there's a sense of diminishing returns as you get further and further into it. But the first you make in this direction are good ones.
Well, the other thing as well is just doing basic exercises. So one of the things I've started doing as well recently, which has helped a lot, is you can get these bits of software that basically enforce these things called micro breaks, where you like it pauses your screen for like a minute every 15 minutes or 30 seconds every 15 minutes. A lot of people who have carpal tunnel syndrome have found these to be really helpful, because what happens is as you're typing and you're getting into it, first of all, again, your shoulders are often rounded, but you're typing a whole bunch. And that kind of bit of your hand, like the fat bit between your thumb and your first finger, often gets inflamed, which is what causes carpal tunnel. So basically, if you have this software and it provides a micro break for like 30 seconds every 10 minutes or whatever you set it to, it basically allows that to calm down a little bit. And there's one called Stretchly, which is open source, and there's a whole bunch for different platforms. And that's, I think, really helps a lot. But then what you do is when you have that micro break, you can go up and look on YouTube, and there's tons of videos of how to stretch your back and move your arms around a little bit. And, you know, it just, it means you do it for 10 seconds, but it's...
That's interesting. I mean, I've got this little kind of, I don't know what you call it, sort of a little plinth that your hand sits on when you're using the mouse. I'm holding up to the video, not that anyone else can see it. But yeah, and Jerry has a similar thing. And mine is two separate bits, and the top one moves independently of the bottom. And the heel of my hand rests on it when I'm using the mouse, and it's padded. I pinched off my dad. The micro breaks thing I think is interesting. And what I thought was more interesting is they're starting to build a lot of this stuff into operating systems at a base level now. So it's no longer, I will go and install an app. It's instead, I'll just turn this on in the settings. So we all agreed that a week ago that we'd turn this on for a week and then we'd report back on our findings. So, so Jono, how did you find it?
I found it great. I spent the entire week using, in my case, the Android version.
Jonathan Bacon.
I forgot to turn it on.
Right. Okay, Jeremy.
So at least for me, it actually defaulted to on, which I was a little surprised about. Yeah. So I don't know if it's a Pixel thing or, but between the, I just kind of messed around with it. I didn't use it for the full week, to be honest. But one of the things I thought was interesting is the bedtime mode. One of the options was at a certain time, you can have it turn your phone into just grayscale to basically annoy you into putting it down.
That is the thing I turned on. I didn't turn on a bunch of the other. I didn't turn on a bunch of the other stuff because, yeah, maybe I should entirely cut myself off from using certain apps after a certain time of night. But I'm not going to. Right, live with the pain.
Oh, so you didn't use it either?
But I turned the bedtime mode on, right?
Okay.
And then forgot that I did it. And then so it turns on at 1 o'clock in the morning. I think it turns off at 8:30. And so the first time, I think it was later that night, a week ago or so, when we first discussed this, I looked at my phone and it was all in black and white. And first of all, I thought, oh, that looks quite trendy. And then I thought, oh, no, is it broken? And then I spent five minutes Googling for why is my phone in black and white before it. Oh, that's what it does. Okay. But it looks quite cool. And it may, and
yeah.
I don't know if this is necessarily the goal, because I think it's meant to make you think, wow, it's really important that I turn off the screen and get away from the screen and concentrate on other things and go to sleep. And what it made me think is, if somebody actually comes out with an e-ink phone, I'm totally buying it.
Right? They're already out there.
Yeah.
Already out there. Isn't, though, the point of the black and white thing, it's less about making you stop using it and more about that it's easier on your eyes?
Eye strain and things like that, yeah.
Also,
and
by the way, did you configure the times for when yours went on and off? Because you having yours go on at 1 a.m. when you're probably already in bed and then go off at 8:30 a.m. and you're never up before 8:30 a.m. It sounds awfully convenient that it's basically never on.
No, that is not true at all. I have it turned on at 1 a.m. because I normally go to bed in between 1 and 2, and it comes back on at 8:30, which I didn't even configure because that's when my alarm goes off. So it picked that. I don't know whether it looked at my alarms and knew or what, but yeah,
right,
yeah. I mean, similarly, I've got, and I have had for years and years and years, the thing on your computer that, you know, when it gets late at night, it reduces the color temperature of the screen or increases the color temperature of the screen or whatever it is.
Right.
So everything goes a bit red or a bit blue.
Yeah,
or
yeah.
Whichever way around it is. The one I...
Those things work.
Yeah. The one I've got, the color temperature is currently 5500K. I can't remember the name of it. It's called Red Light or something like that. Doesn't actually tell you its own name in its menu. That's really annoying. But yeah, so that's on Ubuntu. But I mean, I believe it's built into, you know, whatever Mac you're using, Jono, and
Actually, yeah, I mean, I think if anyone who listened to this, if you're laying in bed at night and looking at your phone and maybe reading Reddit or whatever before you go to sleep, that is really actually disruptive on your sleep. This is one of the reasons why I have to read before I go to bed, otherwise I just can't fall asleep unless I'm knackered. And I always read a Kindle. And a Kindle's great for this because it's got like a little light in it and you're reading e-ink, right? So it's not the same as reading an actual screen. And you just get better sleep out of it. I actually wear a Fitbit that measures my sleep, and I can see when I've been reading on my phone, because I'll sometimes get into the bad habit of reading it for a couple of weeks, looking at my phone before I go to sleep. And then I'll think, oh, I'm tired. And I'll go back to reading the Kindle and I'll be able to see the quality of my sleep improves.
That's
really,
which certainly my phone has some kind of a light detector thing in it. So if it's in darkness, the screen brightness dims. Automatically, right. Which I assume is just built into everything now. I mean, so mine's
definitely Android and I think iOS.
Yeah, I'm assuming it's built into stuff because I didn't turn that on or anything. It just does it.
Did you have any other takeaways from your usage? Because remember, what we talked about this when, was it Google at one of their events and they were banging on about their digital well-being app and how it was going to be. There was all of this virtue signaling about how they cared about the, you know, the health of their users and this, that, and the other. I don't know anyone who uses it. I've not had anyone say, oh, I'm using this digital well-being thing and I just feel so much better. My life is happier because it's on. I don't know. It seems like you're voluntarily reducing the capabilities of your phone.
Because I, in doing a little bit of research for this segment, was curious what usage looked like across, you know, Android, iOS, and maybe some of the other platforms, and could not find a single bit of information about usage. Because, you know, it's built into iOS after 12, it's built into Android, but Android deployed it as in a very Android-y way, where first it came to Pixels, and then it came to other phones ad hoc.
Yeah, right.
And then as of Pi, they built it in, and starting in, I think it was September of 19, if you want to distribute Android, you have to ship a digital wellness app. It doesn't even have to be theirs. They'll provide you theirs. You can alternatively do a different one, but you have to ship something.
Oh, they require it? That you have to ship some kind of...
As of September of 19,
good.
Yes.
Good for them.
But it's interesting that I cannot find any even rough usage numbers on... Obviously, install numbers wouldn't be useful, but usage would be useful and could not even get a rough estimate. But I think Google is definitely all in. I wasn't aware of the experiments.withgoogle.com/digital-well-being, but they have a bunch of these... Some of them are temporary, some of them are permanent, but they are digital wellness experiments. And one of them is you print out an envelope that makes it so that you can basically only use the dialer and the camera. And when you want to uncheck from your phone, you put your phone in this envelope. They have one called the paper phone. They have, there's about
hang
eight
on,
of them
hang on,
currently.
Hang on, get back up for one second. I don't quite understand this. So one of their digital wellness experiments is that they give you an envelope to print out.
Correct.
And then the point is that if you want to become more digitally well, you place your phone into the envelope that you've just made from the printout. And then when you want to use your phone, you take it out of the envelope. Is that correct?
Yeah.
This is where the innovation's happening.
No, this is real.
Am I not digitally well if I use my own envelope? Does it have to be a Google one that I printed out?
It has
from
to
their
be
website?
A Google one. It's like those old cardboard goggles. You got to have it. But they had one
this
activity
is one of
bubbles
the stupidest
where when you
things.
It tells you how much you used an app or how many times you unlocked your phone is one of the settings. So every time you unlock your phone, it drops another bubble onto the stack, and how long you're on your phone, the bubble grows, so you can see immediately how many times and how long you've used your phone. So they're definitely all in on this.
So this is not just an envelope. This is a box with numbers on the front.
Right. Like I said, the
I
envelope
thought you meant literally
you
like
just,
an envelope.
It's like a cutout of your dialer and the camera. So it depends on the
I
phone
you
have.
I thought you meant
have
like
it.
An envelope that you know that you send a letter in. You should put it.
What I don't understand is this person. I mean, I'd call this a very small phone-sized cardboard box rather than an envelope. Fine, but they've got it here. So there's a photo button printed on the envelope. But I don't understand what the point is of pressing the button because your phone's in a box. What's it going to take a picture of?
The inside of the box. It's a high use case requirement.
People who've looked at experiments.withgoogle.com/envelope, do please let us know how you found the Put My Phone in a Box for Digital Wellness. So
because we couldn't find usage, I would be super interested. Join Slack, pop in the channel, let us know whether you use iOS or Android, because their implementations, I noticed, are fairly different and very opinionated. Apple has taken the approach of, we're going to recommend that you please stop using your phone and maybe don't use this app, where Google has been a little more stringent about, you got to stop.
Yeah. Now,
depending on how you have the settings. It's yes. more of a hard delineation of cutting things off, where Apple's is more of a soft recommendation. But I'm curious what platform you use and if you use any of them, because it's really more of a suite of features than a single feature, right? Some of it just tracks app usage. Some of it lets you set timers on apps or timers on your phone or various different timers to remind you of things. Part of it is enabling and disabling Do Not Disturb, the whole grayscale thing, etc. So I'm curious what features you actually do use. And even more importantly, if you found one to be really changing how you use your phone for the long term, because I think some of these things seem to me it would change your usage maybe in the short term, but a lot of these things, just like fitness, I don't consider fitness a thing you do. For it to be effective, it has to be a lifestyle change. You have to commit to it and then do it basically in perpetuity. So I'm curious if there's any specific features here, either iOS feature or Android feature, that you found, a full year later I fundamentally use my phone in a different way because of this feature. Would love to hear about it.
I think what I'm expecting to see happen here is, at the moment it's there, but you've got to dig around in the settings for it a bit. So you've got to be aware of it. You've got to want to turn it on. You've got to set it up yourself. It wouldn't surprise me if in, you know, Android and iOS 14 and 15, we start seeing it being part of the first run experience. When you first set up a phone, it's like it's all turned on and then it has disable digital wellness stuff, and then, you know, by 17 or 18 it's a default thing and they're all turned on by default and you've got to dig around in the settings to turn them off or whatever.
And one early little bit snafu that I'm guessing did impact Android usage is the very right when they rolled this out to the Pixels, there was a bug that caused a lot of battery usage. And every article of the era, if you look back, says the first thing it says is disable digital well-being.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's not good. This is, without wishing to be all, you know, harking back to our pasts as Linux people, this is much like the thing you need to do is turn off Pulse Audio.
Yep.
Thing, you know, when there was a problem, just disable that whole thing. Don't do anything new. Disable that. It's broken. And I think this is the same. If there's ever even a tiny thing with it, a whole bunch of the solutions you get, and I saw the same thing when I was looking around for stuff for this, is people just going, just turn off digital well-being. It's really annoying. So I think there needs to be I don't know if you call it a culture change, but an attitudinal change where people expect this to be on. So people say, but I don't want to turn it off because then my phone's really bright at night. But at the moment, because you've got to manually turn it on, it feels very, I'm opting into this because I'm super interested in digital well-being. You know, it's like being a vegan or something.
Right. I think, and it's to me, it's like, the way recycling has become a thing that's just pretty normal now is that it took years to get to that point, right?
Yeah,
like,
absolutely. People
have become habitually different.
You'll remember, younger listeners may not remember this, but there was certainly a time in offices and things where they started bringing in things like recycling bins. And so everywhere you had two bins rather than one. And people mocked this whole idea to death. Why would I do this and deliberately put things in the wrong bin and all this kind of thing? And now it's just a normal thing. If you deliberately walked up and put the can in the non-can bin, people go, you put that in the wrong bin. Why are you doing that? Because it's not a point anymore.
And what's cool is that I realized this about a couple of months ago, that the vast majority of our trash that we throw out is recycling. Like, we have a very small little black bin for all of the non-recyclable stuff. We have two big recycling bins and then green waste, and the amount of actual non-recyclable stuff now is minimal. What a change in society to get to that point. And we're talking about
20 25 years here,
right? Yeah.
So it was not a quick transition for sure.
No, I mean, it's not clear to me whether digital wellness will fix this by everyone still using staring into their devices 25 years from now, but they'll be grey, or whether, you know, the whole phone trend will have gone away by then and we'll be asking for digital wellness for the telepathic thing in our brain or whatever. But
and the thing is with comparing it to something like recycling, it doesn't make a difference to you if you put your can into the recycling bin or into the other bin. It makes a huge difference to society, and it makes a difference to the people who manage your waste. But with the digital well-being, you've got to be disciplined to use your phone less or to change the way in which you use it. And that's a big ask for people. People suck at that usually. So,
yeah.
Anyway, I think we have talked enough about this whole topic.
Not sure I agree with any of that framing, but a little late in the episode to start that discussion.
You wanna challenge me, Jeremy, before we finish?
So on that bombshell,
we're gonna end. Okay.
Yes. So you should show up and discuss this on the Slack channel, and you can have a fight with Jono there because he's wrong, or fight with Jeremy even though he's right. But before we go, we would like to say a thank you. So Jono, do you want to talk about this?
We would.
Yeah, so we had a friend of the show, Marius Quabeck, reached out and offered very kindly to help edit Bad Voltage. So Marius has got an organization called NerdZoom Media, which you can find at nerdzoom.de, obviously a German organization. And he basically said, you know, would you like some help editing the show? So not that editing Bad Voltage takes a huge amount of time, but it takes time. And so thank you, Marius, for volunteering your time. You didn't have to do that. You didn't have to volunteer this. I know you've been listening to the show for a while. Marius does all kinds of podcast and media related work. So if you're interested in what they're doing, go to nerdzoom.de and you're going to hear about this, because we said, look, we'll put it in the show notes and we'll mention it in every show. So you're going to get to know Marius the more Marius comes and edits our show. So we'll be mentioning this in forthcoming shows. But thank you again. We really appreciate it. And he did like the first edit as a test last week. It sounded awesome. So what you're hearing now is Marius's good work.
Now, our previous editor, quite a nice bloke, but every once in a while would just straight forget to edit the show.
Yeah. The other good thing about this is, from now on, if someone comes to Slack or whatever, or Twitter or something, and says that we got a thing wrong, what it turned out is that we got it right, but then it got broken in the edit, so that's okay.
Yeah, yeah. Fix it in post! So, all right. Okay, so with that, we're going to wrap up. Thank you all for listening. Stay safe, stay well, and we will see you on the next one.